Thanks for being here. It's great that you've made the effort and came along. As I think you know, most of you, if not all of you, that it's one of our digging deeper evenings when we spend more time thinking around a particular issue or a particular biblical passage or theme. And tonight we've decided to look at this idea of Christianity and culture. And my prayer is that somewhere in the mix of all the words and thoughts and discussion, God's will would be done, and that we would find ourselves encouraged or stimulated or challenged to go away and think more or whatever. But Lord, may there be something useful coming out of this tonight. It's a huge subject, as all the subjects are that we choose, and so necessarily this isn't going to be the last word. In fact, I've chosen, rather than to take a particular line, to try and introduce a number of lines that Christians take on this issue, and hopefully there'll be time to have a bit of conversation about the various merits and demerits of the different positions that Christians take. But the core question there, and it's an important question, it's a practical question, it's not a theological or theoretical question, is how do we best interact with our society, a society that's no longer culturally Christian in its outlook? And I think some of us that have been around for a long time, I number myself amongst them now, will have felt in our lifetimes a shift in our culture from norms and attitudes that we could have expected in a whole range of issues to be no longer the case, no longer represented in government and in education and in other parts of our culture. And so we are, in a sense, we're running to catch up with not just a new situation, but with an ever-changing situation. If it was a new situation, we could possibly come to some form of engagement and settle on it. But one of the things about our culture is the constancy of change. Way back in the 1970s, a man called Elvin Toffler wrote a book called Future Shock. And in it, he argued that by the end of the 20th century, change would be constant. Change would be so constant that people would begin to not be able to cope. Society and individuals in society would begin to break down just because of the sheer constancy of change in every area of life. That was his prediction. It wasn't a Christian book, but I think it was a fairly accurate prophetic prediction in the 1970s of how life by the turn of the millennium had begun to change in every aspect. And this is personal confession time, but I, at my age now, I feel that I don't live in the same world that I grew up in. I feel that the world has changed. It's not just that one or two things within it has changed, but I feel like the world has changed and I don't fit anymore. So I feel quite personally, I feel like I'm really struggling to work out how on earth do I live in this world that's not the world I was grew up in and was trained to respond to as a child, not formally trained, but by all the instincts and parenting that, and so on, that there are ways you learn to cope in the world and expectations you have of the world which are just no longer true. Now, I'm not criticizing that. I'm just saying that that is the fact, I think, for a lot of people, certainly of my generation. So we're thinking about it tonight, and as I say, we're thinking about it through a number of different lenses and angles, well, I will make sure there's time for you to talk together and talk back. And the clock is very big and right in front of me, so don't worry, we will definitely be finished by 8, whatever happens in the meantime. So culture, let's just think about the word, just as a few introductory thoughts about culture, what we mean by the word. There's a very erudite book by a scholar called Catherine Tanner called Christ the Key, which is exploring what culture is. And she's also written another book called Theories of Culture. And in her book, she claims that culture is a specific pattern of beliefs and behaviors that distinguish any society from all others. So it's some specific things to do with the way our world works. The shortest and simplest definition that's often trotted out, and it's helpful, is culture is the way we do things around here. It's all of the expectations and norms of the world that we live in. But of course, they're different from other parts of the world where we might live. So eating is not a cultural thing, because all human beings eat. But eating hot cucumber is definitely a cultural trait. of the Dutch, I've discovered many years ago, which took me by surprise. So culture is the way that some parts of the world live differently to other parts of the world, their distant beliefs and behaviors. And one of the things about culture is it doesn't just happen, it's made. Humans are culture-making animals. We make our culture. But here's the interesting thing. We decide to do things in a certain way. We decide on certain values. But then those things that we decide and make begin to shape us. So we shape culture, but culture shapes us. Think of Exhibit A, the mobile phone. That is an item of our culture. It's the way we do things. Having been made by human beings, it's now shaping the life of human beings. Go to any restaurant and watch people across the table frantically trying not to check their phones when they're trying to be having a romantic evening out with their partner. The things that we make, whether it's music, certain sorts of music, we make those cultural forms, but then by constantly listening to them and playing them and exposing us to them, they begin to shape us by what they are. So culture's an interesting thing. It doesn't have to be the way it is, but someone somewhere decided it would be the way it is. And having decided it, there are consequences because it then shapes the way we live. Think of the car. Think of almost anything that's an item of our culture, the way we do things around here. People who study culture call these cultural scripts. They're things that are written into our way of life that we can study and think about and think, well, what, just as you might study a book and think, well, what's this saying? You can study an item like a piece of music or a car or whatever and think, well, what's this saying about our culture and about the way we do things around here? The third introductory comment is that although I'm talking tonight about culture, of course, any culture, our world, the Western world, Thornbury, wherever, is not one big thing. It's made up of lots of subcultures. And the classic example here would be, and I've already referred to it, would be what someone's called youth culture, which is very different to old person's culture. But we're all part of the same Western culture. So there are some underpinning things that we believe, but the way that those things work out are very different. So often in the media, you know, the millennials are talked about, people that did their growing up in the early part of the 21st century. Millennials have a very distinct culture, sometimes cynically referred to by the media as the snowflake culture. But there's enough about their way of life that actually distinguishes them as a group that do things differently to the way that my generation did things and do things. So one of the challenges is when we're trying to relate as Christians to our culture is, well, which bit? to have a single view is really quite difficult. For the sake of simplicity tonight, I'm still going to talk about single view, but in fact, in truth, I get the disclaimer in at the start, it's quite difficult to have a single view. So in diagrammatic terms, I guess this is kind of what we're thinking about tonight. It's how does the culture of God's kingdom and the church relate to the surrounding culture that it finds itself in, and particularly tonight because we are Western Christians, I'm thinking about the West. Because, of course, the church has its own culture. It is a subculture within the bigger culture. The way we do things is distinct, hopefully. If it's not, then we've basically lost the plot. Is distinct from the culture that we're set in. And the world that we're relating to, the world of arts and media and education and leisure and politics and sports and business and could go on and on, all the different strands of our culture demand us to think through how do we, within the Christian culture, relate to that bigger world? Do we engage at all? Because one option that we'll look at is we don't, and we don't need to, and God doesn't expect us to. So I'll repeat the disclaimer. I'm going to offer a number of options, not all of which I agree with, and not all of which I expect you will agree with. But I think I showed you, I did touch on some of this in another talk a while back, this book by Timothy Keller called Center Church. I don't remember waving that around. Timothy Keller is an American preacher, church leader, excellent speaker in my view. And he talked about there being seasons in the life of a church in terms of cultural relationship, the way that the church relates to its culture, parallel to seasons. And he talked about a season of winter when the church is very much embattled. Its culture oppresses it. Its culture doesn't accept it. It's minimized and marginalized. And it's very hard in a church, for a church in that situation, to think it's going to affect its culture very much. Think of the church in any persecuted country, Somalia, North Korea, China. Think of the church in those sorts of settings. And in this analogy, it would be the church in winter. It's an embattled, it doesn't have any prospect of having politicians in parliament or affecting the arts or whatever. It's just holding on faithfully to its faith. Yeah? He then talks about spring, where the church is embattled but still growing. And he would say contemporary China, as opposed to historic China, contemporary China would be an example of that, where the church is still a marginal group, it still has no levers of power or great influence, but it's beginning to grow. And because it's growing, it can no longer be ignored by those in the main body of culture. He talks about summer as being the time when the church is highly regarded and highly influential. And that's probably the state that many of us would have grown up in the West, when the church is highly regarded, particularly in our country and culture, where we've got a state church still. There was a time when it had a lot of influence, bishops in the House of Lords and so on, and the church was just assumed to be the go-to place for all of your institutions, for marriage, for funerals, for Scouts Flag Days, and you know, there's such a strong connection between the cultural life and the church life that it was almost assumed to be the same thing. I'm not saying that that's a good place to be, but it is a place we've been. And that's why sometimes people, in my view, can rather inadvisedly say that Britain was once a Christian country. Technically, correctly, Britain has never been a Christian country. but there was a time when the church was highly regarded and influential in the life of this country, and that did shape some of our culture, some of our laws and expectations. And then he talks about autumn, where the church is increasingly marginalized in a post-Christian culture, where it's losing some of its influence. And his argument is that's where we are now. We're in the autumn of a decline, which may well end in, back in a winter, where again the church is an embattled minority. You see his four pieces of analysis? Does that sort of ring true at all with the way things are and have been? Just talk to the person next to you. What are the strengths and weaknesses of each season of cultural engagement? For the church, what are the significances? Because there are strengths and weaknesses for each of these four seasons. Don't look at that. Please don't look at that. Nothing else to say. Just have a think about that for a moment. What are the strengths and what are the weaknesses? What are the opportunities? What are the threats, if you like, think of it in those terms, of each of those four seasons for the church, if that's where the church is set? So just for a couple of minutes, have a little breakout. Okay. You'll have other opportunities to talk. This is just the amuse-bouche. We're not even as far as the starter yet, so don't... But just briefly, in terms of winter, what are the opportunities, what are the strengths and weaknesses of that for the church? Just shout out quickly. Strong commitment, strong relationships, you feel yourself... A togetherness just for survival. Yep, good. Keep on going on a little fruit. Yep. So the Habakkuk thing, though there are no calves in the stall and so on, yet will I praise you. Yep. What about the spring? What are the opportunities? What's the dynamic there? Quite exciting. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're excited by stories of spring when we hear it from Iran or China, and we hear of the church growing. It encourages us. And of course it does for them as well, because if you are the embattled minority and suddenly you're finding that actually you're still a minority, but you're a pretty big minority now, the dynamic and self-perception begins to change, doesn't it? Summer, strengths, weaknesses? Yeah, it's a good connection. So if we believe that God's laws are for the good of everyone, and if the laws of a country are based on God's law, then that's got to be a good thing. Anybody want to add to that? Or got more resources to do more good? John Wesley's mantra, do all the good you can to all the people that you can with all the resources that you have, or something like that. That's a bit of a misquote, but basically that's this little rule of thumb. Yeah. Sorry? Yeah, it results in complacency. Yeah, yeah, because you think in terms of mission and evangelism, the job's done, which arguably could have been leveled at the church in this country through parts of its life when it appeared like Britain was a Christian country, even though it never was, I tell you again. Autumn. Bit of a wake-up call. What are the opportunities? What are the threats? What are the possibilities? Winter's coming, yeah. Yeah. I think. That's a really good point, Graham. Yeah. Yeah. So because we're afraid of the loss of influence and social standing, we aren't pushed back, but we retreat. And again, I think that's true. You know, we're frightened to say what we believe in certain things in case we get a reaction. We don't know we're going to get that reaction, but the fear holds us back, so we are self-marginalized. That's a good point. Well, can I come back to some of these themes? That's just kind of got your heads spinning, hopefully. Let's think of some Bible texts for a moment and go back to Genesis and think about where perhaps the Bible would track the diversity of cultures to the story of the Tower of Babel. Genesis chapter 11, we read that there was a fairly homogeneous culture, according to this report. The whole earth had one language and the same words, and languages are quite a distinct marker of different cultures. There's a sign here of a monoculture. And you know the story. I'm not going to read all these words. They said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, this project. And the Lord said, look, they are one people, and they all have one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do now will be impossible for them. And so God's plan was to confuse their language, and the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. And arguably, you could say there is the beginning of diverse cultures, scattered, distinct languages. And as soon as you have different languages, you start thinking differently and so on, because of the power of language in forming a culture, which we haven't got time to talk about tonight either. So that's, biblically speaking, we could say, well, why are there so many cultures? Why are there so many nations? Biblically speaking, you could point back to Babel. Now, the interesting thing is what happens in Genesis 12, which, of course, when the book was written, didn't exist. It was just the next bit of Genesis 11, if you see what I mean. So if we were to read on, now the Lord said to Abraham, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you'll be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Well, who are the families of the earth? The families of the earth are the people who've just been dispersed after the Tower of Babel incident. And so God's, an early indicator perhaps, that God's means of reaching the dispersed cultures of the world is this new culture that he brings into being, this new race that he brings into being through Abraham's family tree. And Exodus says it plainly, if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So one part, and we'll come back to what the other part is, one part of God's plan to reach culture. And I would read the idea of the nations in the Old Testament as diverse cultures in which, in the middle of which, Israel was set. One part of God's plan to reach them was that he would use this distinct new culture to do so. Abraham's family, Abraham's children and their children. And there are three distinctives about that kingdom culture, that church culture, and I'm using those labels slippery, and I don't want to get involved in the discussion about Israel tonight, but in my view, the church is Israel expanded, not replaced. Israel expanded so that Gentiles are now welcomed into that historic race of Abraham. So I'm using the language in that way. That culture seems to be based on three things. Firstly, the culture of complete submission to God. If you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then you will be my treasured possession. That there is a part of the vital and perhaps first part of the culture of God's people, which distinguishes them from the culture and the nations, is complete submission to God. The second thing is that they are to be separated from the surrounding culture. So the definitive stories there are the Hebrews being brought out of Egypt, and Israel later after exile being brought out of Babylon. That there's a distinctiveness about God's people that requires a level of separation from the surrounding cultures. Myrtle and I have just been reading through the books of Ezra and Nehemiah in the mornings. What else do you do at breakfast time? And there's that passage which people find very difficult, and it is a difficult passage, when the book of the law is read, having come back from exile, and the people suddenly realize that they've failed God because they have intermarried with the surrounding cultures, the surrounding nations. What should we do, they said. And what Ezra says is, send your wives and children away, which some people find a very difficult thing. Without getting into that this evening, that does nevertheless underscore the importance of the distinctiveness of God's people, the fact that they are separate. They are to be a holy nation, which is about distinctness and separateness. But they're also to be a kingdom of priests on behalf of the other nations. You will be for me a kingdom of priests. Priests are about connecting, standing in the gap between, being a bridge. They are to be those who all the other nations are blessed through. All the families of the earth will be blessed through you. So there's also something about this culture, which is that it's to be a servant culture. It's not to be separate in the sense of hermetically sealed, keep the horrible pagans out, but it is to be a distinct culture which, out of its distinctness, chooses to be God's means of reaching the rest of the world. You can come back at me on any of this. Jesus picked up that sort of idea in the well-known passage in Matthew 5 when he said, you are the salt of the earth. If the salt loses its saltiness, there's the separation, the distinctiveness, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot. You're the light of the world. There's the distinction. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp put it under a bowl. And so on, you know the passage. Let your good deeds shine before others so that they may see them and glorify your Father in heaven. There's the servants of the nations. You know, you are to be there so that others will get drawn into God's family tree, as it were. And one take that the Bible has on this is that actually the culture around us is quite hostile and quite fallen. Famously again, 1 John 5, we know that we're God's children, as the submission and separation bit, and that the whole world lies under the power of the evil one. And we know that the Son of God has come and has given us understanding so that we may know him who is true, and we are in him who is true, in his Son, Jesus Christ. He is the true God and eternal life. Little children, keep yourselves from idols. What you see in that passage is a lot of submission and separation and virtually nothing about servanthood. Maybe John's church had moved into winter. The early church, you know, the first Christians, they suddenly realized they were an embattled minority Remember in the book of Acts, they weren't popular for very long. So that's a little bit, a few introductory comments about kingdom and church culture, but what about the surrounding culture? What does the Bible say about surrounding culture? Well, what we mustn't think is that the Bible says God's in the church and he's abandoned the world. He's abandoned culture. So there are some striking verses which talk about God's ongoing engagement with his world, the cultures outside of his people. The Psalms, the Lord is good to all. He has compassion on all he's made. Heather read this verse last Sunday evening at the prayer meeting, and it sort of, I noticed it thinking about tonight. You know, Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it, for he founded it on the seas and established it on the waters. So it's not just that Israel are the Lord's and everybody else has been abandoned, but the earth is the Lord's and everything in it. There's a sense in which, despite the separateness of Israel, they were still to think of the world as God's world, the cultures as God's culture. And how that is to happen is the nub of the issue. What does it mean? Paul in Athens, in the book of Acts, from one man God made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth. There's a diversity of cultures. And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of the lands. So he didn't just dismiss them, but he tended to care for them. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. Who's he talking to? The church? No, he's talking to pagan philosophers on Mars Hill. In him, everybody lives and moves and has their being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Who? The church? No, Paul's talking to outsiders. So there's a general sense in which God certainly hasn't abandoned his world and chosen to live in the church. But holding those two things together in some kind of tension is a challenge, because some Christians will lean that way and see the whole world as abandoned by God, a godless place, and culture, therefore, to be shunned and avoided. Others will see, actually, that God is equally in the world and the church, and therefore, well, whatever we do in the world is the same as doing it in the church. There's no difference. And we'll come to some of those different thoughts in a minute. But what we're working with here is what theologically is called the idea of common grace. That whilst there is a kind of a saving grace which God extends to the church, there is a common grace which God continues to show to all people. He hasn't abandoned them. Jesus said, the rain falls on the just and the unjust without distinction. So don't go thinking that you were particularly just because you got wet on Thursday. The rain falls on everybody equally. Pushed even further by Paul in Romans chapter 13, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted. For the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for rulers do not bear the sword, execute justice, for no reason. They are God's servants, agents of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. So there's a very strong view of the way that God runs the world. He doesn't run the world through the church. He runs the world through the powers that he set up, the powers of politics and justice. He's quite capable of doing that. And we as Christian people should recognize God's provision for the world that is not currently in his church, to try and keep them safe and to provide for them. God has provided for systems of justice and systems of fairness through something other than the church. And that point is argued quite strongly and to the nth degree in this book called The Endangered Gospel, How Fixing the World is Killing the Church. And he says, actually, it's not the church's job to run the world. God's provided for that. He is capable of doing that. It says in the Bible, it's already happening. God has instituted systems of politics and justice. We don't need to get involved in that. We don't need to think that our job as the church is to run the world, just as we would never dream anyway if we were a church in winter in the previous analogy of the seasons. Why do we think that? Because we've been a church in summer. That's why we think that that's actually part of our job. That's his argument in there, and I'll come back to him later. And it's an interesting argument to think about, based on this passage. So what is the relationship then between surrounding culture and church culture? Well, here's an imaginary exercise I want you to do for a few minutes, and see how you get on with this. I'm not sure. I'm going to go with it, and you're probably going to shoot me down for it. But anyway, imagine if Rome, in Jesus' day, had called an election for a new governor of Judea, and the citizens of Israel, God's people, in the middle of other cultures, were permitted to vote. Would Jesus have voted? The two candidates are Felix. As Felix's political fortunes rose, so did his reputation for corruption, cruelty, and lust. Felix governed Judea from 52 AD to 60 AD with the power of a king but the mind of a slave. No current politicians, I'm sure, were in mind. According to the Roman historian Tacitus, Pontius Pilate is the other candidate in the election. He was the Roman prefect or governor of Judea around AD 26 to 37, still running for office, and is most famous for presiding over the trial of Jesus as described in the Bible. So a little imaginary exercise. Imagine that Jesus lived in a democratic Rome, and as part of God's people, Israel, he was invited to take part in the elections in his country. Would he have voted? And if so, which candidate would he have chosen? Okay, over to you for just a few minutes. Down, so I assume you've got that one sorted out. So, just a show of hands, how many people thought Jesus would have voted in the election? Okay, so about two-thirds thought he would have voted. yeah. And in terms of the two candidates, how would he have decided? And who went for Felix? Okay, Felix got null point. Pontius Pilate? Okay, so he would have voted for Pilate. I won't ask the rationale for that. I can guess why somebody might have said, thought that. So he would have voted for the man who was to sign his death warrant. There's a certain logic to that, given that he knew he was going to die. I can follow that. Yeah, so I hope you found that an interesting thing to think through, because, of course, there are some Christians who would say, based on this idea that it's not the job of the church to run the world, voting is really difficult. And one of the reasons it's really difficult is because who do you vote for? And you tend to vote, well, a lot of people perhaps tend to vote out of self-interest. Who's going to make me better off? Perhaps other people might vote because of the person they disagree with least. which is the choice you're left with, isn't it? Who is most in line with the things that I believe in and value, recognizing that there will be a downside to just about anyone I vote for who probably won't reflect my values and principles. So the challenge of politics is very interesting. If you're interested in reading about politics, there's a really excellent book on political theology called The Desire of the Nations, written by Oliver O'Donovan, who is Professor of Moral and Pastoral Theology at Oxford University and Canon of Christchurch. He's a really good writer, he's a Catholic. He's a really good writer, he's written some really good books. They're the kind of books you probably need to read in small doses when you're awake. So don't try and read it all at bedtime. But if you're interested in thinking through Christians and politics, it's certainly one you, I think, dare I say, should have read and thought through and engaged with. Well, the Princeton Seminary Bulletin says, this book should be read. So who am I to disagree? Yeah, by more than one person, I think is the inference. Okay, so let's just move on and try and just break this down a little bit more into different ways that Christians think about their culture, and not just politics, but other aspects of the way our world is. And we're going to use some lenses provided by a man called Richard Niebuhr, who wrote a book called Christ and Culture in the 1950s. Some of you may have come across that. It's a kind of classic in its own way. It's not without its faults and weaknesses, and his approach is criticized by some, but it's a helpful kind of set of lenses to look through, I think, to try and feel our way forward as to the different ways that Christians think about culture. So there he is. He looks rather spooky in this photograph. I'm not sure, it's a rather over-photoshopped picture, but anyway, that's him. He's an American philosopher, teacher, university lecturer, Christian, and he thought of these five different positions that Christians take in terms of culture. And the first, at the extreme left-hand or right-hand end, depending where you want to put it, but this is the one extreme, is that Christ is against culture. The world is hopelessly corrupted, and the only viable response is to withdraw and to form our own communities. And there are, of course, some contemporary examples of that. The Amish in America, for example, would typically take this somewhat extreme view that we don't want any of this modern stuff like televisions and cars and modern conveniences and education and so on. The world is fallen, the verse I referred to earlier, the whole world is under the power of the evil one, we must distance ourselves and create new cultures. I came across another Bruderhof community down in East Sussex, been in the news recently. I don't know if you see, I think there might even be a television program on about it soon. It's on Thursday, yeah. So they would exemplify this view, and it's a very ancient view, ancient theologian, doctor of the church in the second century, Tertullian. He saw culture as a land of alluring idols to be avoided. Contact with culture is defiling. The church is an alternative society, famous phrase. It's an ark of salvation drifting upon a sea of rolling sin. So extreme language, I guess, of its time, it perhaps sounded more acceptable. But that idea of the church being an ark of salvation is a very common one in some of the early church fathers, that basically the world is drowning and God has graciously provided a means of escape and anyone can jump on the ark. It's not like Noah's ark where the door is slammed shut and nobody else can get in, but there is an ark of salvation that's floating here for us. So that's one view, Christ against culture. That's on one end of Niebuhr's spectrums. At the other end, stage right, is the Christ of culture. The Christ of culture seeks to eliminate any distinction between Christianity and culture. While seeking to find common ground, Christ always ends up being subordinated to culture. So this would be the view that there is no special revelation in the church, there's no special revelation in Scripture, that God is to be found everywhere and anywhere. Why we don't really need the church. It's quite a common view, actually, nowadays. That actually God is everywhere, in him we live and move and have our being, so I can equally well do church down the pub with my mates or walking on the hills. I don't need any sort of religious institution or any particular holy book because I can find God in anything and everything. A famous theologian connected with this view is a man called Paul Tillich, who died in the 1920s, 50s, I think, anyway, whatever. He lived through the First World War, and he was a Lutheran pastor, and he fought in the First World War and found it very difficult to find God in the trenches, and was quite affected in his faith by what he discovered there. And he went to, during a break from the fighting, he went to an art gallery, and he saw this picture by Botticelli, Madonna with the singing angels. And he had a very profound experience by looking at this picture. It moved him very deeply. And so much so that he began to develop a way of thinking about God and culture, which completely lowered any barriers, the barriers I've been sort of talking about between church and culture. He said, they don't exist. God is everywhere. He can find him anything. God is in all things. And he came up with this phrase about religion as being It's not about Jesus Christ, it's not about God, it's about ultimate concern. Every human being is religious. No one is an unbeliever, for everybody actually has something that they believe in deep down as being the most important thing to them, and they order their life by that. And although they don't know it, that most important thing to them is really God in disguise. So he lowers the bar in terms of any distinctiveness between Christian revelation and Christian tradition and Christian community and Christian scripture, and says that God is in everything, so not anything goes, but we shouldn't, we should seek Christ everywhere, put it positively, we should seek Christ everywhere. Now there are three, so that's the two extremes. With me so far? Some of you look, yeah, I am, but I don't want to be. Okay, so there are... There are three mediating positions, as you would expect of mediating positions, in the middle. The first he calls Christ above culture. Everything that's good in culture is a gift from God, but it's incomplete until it's brought into the service of Jesus Christ. So culture now isn't good. We can't just take it wholesale, but we can, to use language that he doesn't use, redeem it. I remember when I worked for Scripps Union years ago, we had some musicians on our team, one of whom was a reggae singer called Ben Okafor. And Ben was quite a character. He's Nigerian and had the thing, you know, the dreadlocks, the full. We did a school's mission week in Torquay, and Ben doubled the black population of Torquay just by driving in at that time. And he used to do this thing with his guitar, he used to do this jokey thing with kids. And he was quite a novelty because... There were, you know, not joking, there was virtually no black population in Torquay at the time. And we had this class of 12-year-olds, all quite wrapped, and Ben with his dreadlocks and looking very cool and unteacher-like. And he started singing his guitar. He said, I'm going to sing you a song about my favorite food. And he started playing the song for ages. And then suddenly, he shook his dreadlocks and sort of jumped towards the children and said, mashed potato! And that was it. And these kids got leapt back in absolute shock. At what had just happened. It was just completely unlike anything that had ever happened in their school before. But I was at a Scripps Union conference when Ben was playing for a sort of staff conference, and somebody prayed, and they said, oh God, thank you so much for Ben redeeming reggae. And at the time, that really sounded strange to me. Can you redeem art forms? Can you redeem cultural artifacts? But that was the mindset, that Ben had taken something that was in culture. It was a gift from God, but until it had been redeemed, it wasn't actually being used rightly. Historic figure Thomas Aquinas, you may have heard of him, a famous scholastic theologian of the 13th century. All of his thinking was based on the philosophy of Aristotle, but he kind of Christianized it. He took Aristotle's view of an understanding of the way the world is and brought it into the service of the church. Those are examples of Christ above culture in Niebuhr's terms. Another view is, this is the fourth, nearly there, is Christ and culture in paradox. So this view, culture is good but fallen and exists in tension with Christ's kingdom. Christians must learn to navigate the tensions between the two kingdoms and restore the good. So this idea is that there are two cultures, and Christians have to live in both of them. It's associated with a man called Augustine, who wrote a book called where he talked about two cities, the city of God and the city of man. And you have to live in the city of man, but the eternal city is the city of God. And as a Christian, that's your place of dwelling, but you can't only dwell there because you have to go to the shops and you may end up watching a film or whatever. So you enter the city of man. And when you enter the city of man, you're kind of constrained by the way the city of man does things. So you kind of have to do things the way they do things, but God understands that. So here's something. Christ's servants, whether they're kings or princes or judges or soldiers, are bidden, if need be, to endure the wickedness of an utterly corrupt state, and by that endurance to win for themselves a place of glory in the heavenly commonwealth, whose law is the will of God. So he's not saying you should depart from an utterly corrupt state. You've got to do your work there. If you're a soldier or you're a judge, that's where you are got to be. And while you're there, you have to submit to the way things are done there. You can't do otherwise. This was developed, and of course Augustine was writing around the time when the church had become the official state religion. The Roman church had become the official state religion. He was a bishop in North Africa. And now he had to reckon with, well, how do we do business? Now that the state, and there's so many Christians around, but the state's still doing what states do, how do we relate? Centuries later, a man called Martin Luther, who you will have heard of, he picked up this idea, and his idea of two governments. God has ordained two governments, the spiritual, which by the Holy Spirit under Christ makes Christians and pious people, and the secular, which restrains the unchristian and wicked, so they're obliged to keep the peace outwardly. You can see echoes of Paul again in Romans 13. But his point was that when you live in the culture, you have to obey the laws of the culture. You can't help that. God knows that. God understands that. You're living in a corrupt world. So an example of that might be, for example, a Christian who believes with all of their heart that it's right to forgive your enemies, that thou shalt not kill, but joins the military. So when I'm in the military, it's okay not to forgive but and to kill, but in my private life, I don't actually believe that. So I'm living in two different kingdoms, but that's okay because God can understand that because I'm participating in a means of justice to the world, the armed forces, and God's ordained that means of justice. Can you see the way that that kind of works? I don't know if you saw in the week an interesting case in Australia where there were a Christian couple who had refused to pay tax, arguing that it was against God's will. Here they are. Mr. Beerypoot. I'm not sure how you say his name. It surely can't be like that. But anyway, Mr. Beerypoot had argued that the law of God is the supreme law of this land, and making people pay tax was weakening their dependency on God, an act which was leading to curses in the form of droughts and infertility. Transferring our allegiance from God to the Commonwealth would mean rebelling against God and therefore breaking the first commandment, he said, according to the public broadcaster. So that was his view. He was kind of like view one. The world's a wicked place. I need to have nothing to do with it, including paying taxes. Unfortunately, the prosecutor had a Christ in paradox view and came back with. In his judgment, Associate Justice Stephen Holt said that while he believed the Beerypoot's beliefs to be genuinely held, he said there was no specific reference in the Bible to support their argument. In my view, the Bible effectively said that civil matters and the law of God operate in two different spheres. Perfect statement of Christ in paradox. There's a law here. You've got to obey this law, even though you don't believe it. You sincerely believe it. I'm not questioning. You're not just cranky people trying to get out of paying your taxes. You really believe this, but your beliefs don't count here, and you've got to live according to this law when you're in this realm. Yeah, so I'm not defending their viewpoint. I'm just saying that whatever he is.
But the judge is wrong, isn't he? And he's saying his paradox view doesn't fit that, does it?
His last statement is the paradox view. Yes.
He's saying it's two different spheres, and actually in the Bible, you know, render unto Caesar what Caesar's.
Yes, which some people would say actually. Which some people would say is actually authenticating. Render unto Caesar what's Caesar's and under God what's God's. There is biblical justification for the Christ in paradox view, some would say. Mel, really good question. Can I carry on just for a minute? That's right. I refer to this book again, this Endangered Gospel, in this view, actually. He says, the tasks of keeping sin in check, meeting basic needs, and making the world a better place are crucial for human thriving. But they are tasks that God has assigned to ordinary human power structures. The kingdom-centered view gives up the desire to make this world a better place and embraces instead the church's unique commission of being God's better place in the world. in the hope that as many unbelievers as possible might encounter and enter God's kingdom. So although it's not exactly, that's sort of this view, that there are two realms, there are two kingdoms, and God's got one in hand. We don't need to worry about that. God's still the ruler of the nations. We need to get on with being, Tertullian's ark of salvation, so that people can enter. I've lost count now. Is this the last one? I think it's the last one now. One more. Christ, the transformer of culture, is the final one. So in this view, culture is good but fallen and exists in tension with Christ's kingdom. But since Christ is Lord over all creation, Christians should actively try to transform the culture to be more in accord with the kingdom of God. You get that? So this is one a view of engagement. Christ is Lord of everything. In one place, the church, he is Lord in fact, de facto. In most places, he is Lord de jure, as of right. He's rightfully the Lord of the world, but he's not yet, in fact, the Lord of the world. Do you remember? You get the distinction between that. It's a bit like when King Alfred was King of England, the greatest King of England, when Winchester was the capital city. De jure, as of right, he was king of a united England for the first time, but there were still nasty groups of Welsh people and Scottish people who were fighting against his kingship. So he wasn't actually a king there because they weren't doing what he wanted, but he had the right to be king there. So this is this view, okay? So Jesus is de jure, as of right, the Lord of everything, but he's not yet in fact. So we need to work to bring to bear on the world Christ's kingdom and Christ's kingship and let them know who the king really is. And the classic figure, perhaps historically related to this, is a man called Abraham Kuyper. Have you heard of Abraham Kuyper? He's an incredible man, Dutch man. He's one of those people that did everything and did it really well to the nth degree. He was a journalist. He was Prime Minister of Holland from 1901 to 1905. He founded a new reformed denomination in Holland, and it became the second most numerous church in Holland in the early part of the 20th century. He was just one of those, a really strong Christian. This is what he famously said. No single piece of our world is to be hermetically sealed off from the rest, and there is not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign of all, does not cry, mine. The media, mine. Cinema, mine. Education, mine. The arts, mine. But it's not yet clearly. And so Christians need to work to infiltrate those fallen structures, to bring them back under the rightful lordship of Christ. And this view is one that underpins a lot that we would take for granted, I suspect, in our church tradition. The idea of transforming culture by our presence within it. Let me just offer you one more Bible story and then a bit of conversation, and then we're virtually heading towards the end. And as always, I've got far too much material. This is slide 27 of 41. So just the story, the Bible book really, which probably has most to offer us in terms of resource for thinking through Christ and culture, I would suggest, is the book of Daniel. So in the book of Daniel, you have four young Hebrew men pitched into a foreign culture, Babylon, taken prisoner, taken to Babylon, and then forced to work for the culture. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego get positions of influence and power within Babylon as Hebrew believers. And we read something of the tension that they experience between their faith, praying regularly and openly and refusing to stop doing so, and the culture of Babylon, which is that they should only pray to Nebuchadnezzar. And the tension between the two cultures is very extreme. And in chapter 2, or 3, I forget, sorry, forgive me, we read that the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts. and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, the chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. So here, in our terms, is a Christian who's got incredible influence in their culture. Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king, which was a privileged place of power. So this is an interesting mix of cultures here. People who we know are determinedly and authentically Hebrew, now functioning within the political wheels of fallen Babylon. And you know the story. The king is told, there are certain Jews whom you've set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who've not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you've set up. Remember the great statue that Nebuchadnezzar set up? Now, there were many gods in ancient Babylon, and he set up one statue. The single statue represented all the diverse gods of his culture, all the gods you had to keep happy to get on in life. This monolithic statue of himself represented. And everybody was expected to bow down to the gods of culture. These are the things we need to do to get on in life. But of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused. Senior politicians refusing to bow the knee to the cultural idols. And we know what happens. They get thrown into the furnace and threatened. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we've got no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, that you're going to throw us into the fiery furnace, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, if he doesn't, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. And we know how the story develops. They are thrown into the furnace, and Nebuchadnezzar gets very upset because he's commanded that three people should be thrown into the furnace, and he finds a fourth person has gone in without his permission. Ways to upset people in authority. But I think that's a really interesting story of engagement and distinctiveness. Now, I wonder how that overlays onto those five theories. Where do Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego sit in Niebuhr's five categories? Which one are they exemplifying in their behavior? You have 3 minutes to decide. Okay, some of you look like you've run out of things to say, so I'm not going to ask you what you think the answer is to this one, but I hope in the exercise of thinking it through, it's just reinforced some of the ideas, and I think it's an interesting question, if we had time to push it further. What things in your personal engagement with culture brings you to the point where you're confronted with idols of our time, which you refuse to bow down to? Where is the point in your engagement with media, with arts, with politics, with commerce, with business? Where is the point at which you're asked to bow down to an idol, as it were, and the point at which you say, I cannot do that, and if it means losing my job or losing my life, I cannot do it? If you're a teacher, where would that line be? If you worked in the NHS, where would that line be? Really tough, really tough. No easy answers, and I'm certainly not pointing any fingers, but I'm just saying that that seems to me to be the question that the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego points us towards in terms of engagement with culture. We serve culture, we bless culture, we make culture thrive. Remember when God put his people, when God led his people to go into exile, they were told to pray for the place where they'd been sent, pray for its blessing, that it would thrive, so that their lives would be good there too. Where is the point at which you say this far and no further? And you're threatened with the lion's den or the. I think we need to pray for one another and be aware that as we move into autumn, in that former analysis of things, there will be, for all of us who work in or live in our culture, those moments of challenge about bowing to the idols of our time. And I think as a Christian community, we need to be supportive of one another who are facing and making those difficult decisions. Without pointing the fingers or saying this is what you should do, but when people make a decision that's difficult, we need to be fully supportive of them. Okay, I had so much more. I just want to finish with a reference, a diagram, and an idea in 5 minutes. It's not going to happen, but I'm going to do my best. Okay, I want to refer to a book. One of the groups of people who critique Niebuhr are two men called Stanley Hauerwas and William Willimon in their book Resident Aliens. And their view is different. They view in their book three different kinds of church. They call it the conversional church. This is the ark of salvation. We're just here to save souls. The activist church. This is the we need to get out there and make the world a better place group. And both of them, they say, are missing the point and something very foundational to being God's people. And that is the idea of community, of being the better place, to use the language from that other book I showed you. And their third view is they call the confessing church. They reject both the individualism of the conversionists, this is all about making individuals right for heaven, and the secularism of the activists, let's lower the bar and just get involved with everything. And they say the confessing church finds its main political task to lie not in the personal transformation of individual hearts or the modification of society, but rather in the congregation's determination to worship Christ in all things. Now, that you have to read the book. I haven't got time to do it justice. That doesn't mean they say you should withdraw from everything. So they're not going back to the Amish view. But it's a really... They take their idea from the book of Peter, which talks about us as Christians being aliens and strangers in this world. The idea of being an alien, if that appeals to you, read this book. It's very readable, unlike the other book I waved around earlier, and for me, it's got a lot of really good things. It's one of those books, when I read it, I just kept saying, yes, yes. It's one of those moments when all the things you've been thinking suddenly fall into place, and somebody else has said it, but they're clever, so it must be right. So that's a good book. That was the book. Didn't mean to do that. Diagram, and then we're done. Back to Tim Keller. He also tries to outline different ways that Christians engage with culture. Four views in his case. He picks up Luther's idea of the two kingdoms and say that the way we engage is through our secular vocations. We live in the world. We have to do our job. We have to do the job according to the rules of the world. So let's just get on and do it. That's the two kingdoms view. He talks about a transforming culture by social action view, which he calls the relevance view. We need to be relevant, we need to be accepted, we need to be in with what's going on in culture. We don't need to be too critical, we just need to be accepting, because Jesus was accepting, and so we just go with the flow. I just picked Oasis Trust as one of many Christian organizations, or formerly Christian organizations, that are willing to, for example, to run a Christian school without Christian staff. For example. So we just want to be out there doing good as best we can. He talks about the countercultural view, which is sort of the Amish, but not that extreme. This would be the resident aliens view, I think. Serving culture by forming what he calls contrast societies and radical disciples, that this is our job. If we make radical disciples, the world will change. We don't need a political way of doing it. If we make radical disciples, that will influence the world, salt and light. And then his fourth view is the what he calls the evangelical view, which is the Christ transforming culture view, influencing culture by infiltration. So that would be like, we need more Christians in Parliament. We need to be fruitful on our front lines. That sort of view. We want to transform the world by our presence there. Now, he makes an interesting observation, which is that, back to some language we thought of earlier, those top two have a very high view of common grace. Remember, we talked about common grace, God's continuing engagement with his world. They've got a high view of finding God in the world and finding God at work in the world, and that's not a bad thing. Whereas the bottom two have a lower view of common grace. They think the world is an alien and a hostile and evil place, and we just need to be very careful about engaging with it, or we need to engage to transform it. And on the other axis, the two on the left-hand side of the screen are fairly passive in influencing culture. They hope it will happen through making disciples in the Anabaptist tradition, or they hope it will happen through engaging culture through secular vocations, but there is no active strategy to change the world. Whereas on the other end of the axis, they really want to change the world. There's an activism there. They're really trying to change things and to influence things. And what I like about Keller's view is that he refuses to allow those four views to be polarized, and he says that actually there's some really helpful insights in each one, what he calls blended insights. And he picks out these things, that in the Two Kingdoms view, there is a spirit of humble excellence. We want to be the very best doctor we can be, the very best judge we can be, even though we're working with tools and laws and stuff that actually is not really what we would have chosen. We want to be the best at this that we can be. In the liberal view, he says that there's a really good heart for the common good. There's a really good heart to serve and to bless. Whatever they're missing, they're certainly getting this right, that they are set on making the world a better place. The evangelicals, well, they're really good because they've got this distinctive worldview. They know they're salt and they shouldn't be salt that's lacking favor. They know they're light and they shouldn't put the light under a bucket. They know there's a distinctiveness, and they want to retain that distinctiveness when they engage with the world. And the Anabaptist view, he says, as he labels as the Anabaptist view, they're really strong on community. They really want a fellowship of believers to be together and supportive and praying and building one another up in the faith. And he said, wherever you stand, whichever line you stand on that line looking back to the center, not out towards the extremity. That's his gracious analysis. And I think that's really helpful, which is why I finished with it. That whichever place, and I suspect if we went around the room and we forced everyone to say, where do you naturally feel most comfortable? Where do you feel your life is positioned? We would all have a place. We might put an X on the line, either far out or near in. But I think that plea that Keller makes for sort of a graciousness and an honouring of the good that's in the other traditions, we might want to discuss the weaknesses in those other traditions, but let's not lose the good that's in those positions and allow them to stir us and to challenge us to be the people that God wants in the world today. So I think I'm going to finish with...
At the risk of getting you into trouble for overrunning.
Yes. Well, it's willing to a level, yes, to a level. There's a Christian distinctiveness there about humility and so on. But I think the point is that you're exercising that humble excellence within a domain which is not necessarily as you'd like that domain to be, were it fully governed by Christ. But you're going to serve it anyway because you feel that's what your mission is. Well, yeah, that's another thing, you know, I wish we'd had time to think about, I'm running the risk here tonight, and I'll disavow this as I finish, of saying, you know, the church is a brilliant culture, and we've got it all together, and there's these other cultures out there we need to kind of make just like us, if only, you know. So, but one of the things I would have thought about if I had time is how the culture that we live in affects the church. So, for example, we were going to look at, and I'm not going to look at it, but I'm just going to tell you what we were going to look at. We're going to look at the issue of consumerism and think we live in it's one of the major traits of our culture. It's easy for us to say, well, we're not like that, but of course we are. We can't not be. We've been trained to be. And so what difference does it make to live in a culture that's consumerist when the consumerism gets inside the church? What does it do to church and church culture? So there's a two-way thing. We've been thinking about how church influences culture, but if we'd had another 3 hours, we could have thought about how culture influences the church and reflected on that because it's a two-way thing. Definitely. Pardon? Part two? Yeah, what, 8:30? You want a break? And then, oh, I don't know. Definitely, that was not an offer. Definitely. Yeah. Well, I'll see if there's enough there for another whole part. But anyway, that's what it is. That's what it is. And I think Keller's gracious plea for a humble holding of the position that we believe in, and honest conversations between people that hold different views, but nevertheless a determination to go back to what I had on the screen earlier, which is to be those people who are, what were they? Submitted to God, separated from the world, but nevertheless servants of the culture in which we live. That seems to me to be a reasonably good, if simple, biblical framework. Thank you, folks. I'm sorry I've gone 5 minutes over time.